Picture a cold British morning in November 1940. There is a war on. The Luftwaffe has been hammering London for months. The Battle of Britain is barely over, and the Royal Air Force is scrambling for whatever it can get into the air. Every scrap of aluminum, every machined part, every hour on every factory floor is spoken for. The country is running on fumes and stubbornness, and at De Havilland Aircraft Company in Hatfield, England, a beautiful slender twin-engine airplane rolls out of the hangar. It looks like nothing else flying. Long tapered nose, two powerful engines hanging under a high aspect ratio wing, graceful elliptical tail surfaces, almost delicate from a distance. There is one thing about this airplane that sets it apart from everything else in the Royal Air Force inventory. It is built almost entirely out of wood. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and today on the hangar we're going back to Hatfield to talk about the De Havilland DH-98 Mosquito, the airplane the Air Ministry didn't want, the airplane that survived being cancelled, survived being doubted, survived being dismissed as obsolete before it ever left the ground, and then went on to become arguably the most versatile, most feared, and most beloved combat aircraft of the entire Second World War. Pull up a chair. This is a good one. Today's program is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. To understand why the Mosquito was such a radical idea, you have to understand what British aviation thinking looked like in the late 1930s. The prevailing doctrine was this: if you send bombers over enemy territory, they need guns, multiple turrets, a crew large enough to man them around the clock. The Bristol Blenheim had a dorsal turret. The Vickers Wellington had front, rear, and belly positions. The Avro Lancaster that was coming down the design pipeline would carry seven Browning machine guns. The logic made sense on its face. Flying into defended airspace, you needed firepower to fight your way in and fight your way home. Geoffrey de Havilland saw it differently. De Havilland was already a legend by the late 30s. He had been designing aircraft since before the First World War. His company built the Moths, the light planes that defined British private aviation between the wars. He understood aerodynamics at a level most people only read about in textbooks, and his central idea was elegant. What if the airplane was so fast that it didn't need guns at all? The concept he brought to the Air Ministry in 1938 was this: a twin-engine, high-altitude, unarmed bomber, built primarily of wood. A crew of just two pilots, no turrets, no gun positions, no heavy armor plate, strip all of that dead weight away, give it two Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, clean the aerodynamics down to nothing that didn't need to be there, and you end up with an aircraft so fast that enemy fighters simply cannot close the range. The Air Ministry said no. They said no politely at first, then with considerably more conviction as the conversations wore on. Wood was considered obsolete, unarmed bombers were considered suicidal, and there was a matter of manufacturing capacity. The Air Ministry saw Britain's skilled aluminum fabricators as a strategic resource. Wooden construction, to their thinking, was a step backward into a previous era. Geoffrey de Havilland did not give up. He funded early development work out of his own company's pocket. He kept his engineering team working, and when war broke out in September of 1939, the Air Ministry was suddenly a great deal more interested in anything that had a chance of hurting Germany. The contract came through in March of 1940, not a generous contract, not an enthusiastic one. The Ministry wanted a small number built as an experiment, but it was a contract. De Havilland and his chief designer, R.E. Bishop, got to work. The structure they devised was unlike anything that had been mass-produced for military aviation. The fuselage was a sandwich, two thin plywood skins, inner and outer, bonded to a balsa wood core between them using a glue called redux that had just been developed. The layers were formed over a concrete mold, shaped under pressure, and cured into a smooth monocoque shell. The result was light, rigid, and enormously strong for its weight. You could knock on it, and it would ring. The wing was a single-piece structure, left tip to right tip, built as one continuous unit and then mated to the lower fuselage. That was unusual even in metal construction. In wood, it was a remarkable engineering achievement, and the workforce that could build it was already waiting. Furniture factories, piano manufacturers, cabinet makers, any craftsman who spent his career working with hardwood to fine tolerances. De Havilland had identified the labor pool before the Air Ministry had signed anything. Two Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, the same family powering the Spitfire, the Hurricane, and later the Lancaster, hung under that wing in streamlined nacelles. Now here's where it gets interesting. When the prototype flew on the November 1940 with Geoffrey de Havilland's own son, Geoffrey Jr. at the controls, The airplane performed beyond what even the design team had dared hope. It was faster than the Supermarine Spitfire. The unarmed wooden bomber was outrunning the Royal Air Force's premier fighter, the aircraft that had beaten back the Luftwaffe that summer. The prototype was clocked at over 380 miles per hour in initial trials. Later operational marks would push past 415, at a time when the most capable German interceptors were doing 330, 340 miles per hour on a good day. The Mosquito was simply gone before they could close the range. De Havilland had been right. The Air Ministry came around, and they came around fast. What is remarkable about the Mosquito story is not just the design, it is what the airplane became once the doubters got out of the way. They built the first production variants as high-altitude photo reconnaissance aircraft. Speed and altitude were the only protection they needed. Cameras sat in a pressurized bay in the belly. Mosquito photo recon aircraft ranged over Germany, Norway, occupied France, the Norwegian fjords where German capital ships were hiding, coming back with photographs that intelligence officers could barely believe. The airplane could reach altitudes where the Luftwaffe had almost nothing to intercept it, and what they did have could not catch it. Then came the bomber. The Mosquito bomber carried 4,000 pounds of bombs internally that matched the payload of early marks of the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, a four-engine American heavy bomber with a crew of 10. The Mosquito, with two men, carried the same load, and because it was fast, Bomber Command could use it in ways impossible for the heavy aircraft. Low-level precision attacks in daylight, strikes against specific buildings in the middle of occupied cities. The Mosquito went after the Gestapo in September of 1942. Mosquitoes from No. 105 Squadron attacked the Gestapo headquarters in Oslo, Norway. They came in low over the rooftops at nearly 300 miles per hour, delivered their bombs with precision, and were gone before the anti-aircraft guns could find their bearing. The Gestapo building was gutted. In January of 1943, on the 10th anniversary of Adolf Hitler coming to power, Hermann Göring was delivering a speech in Berlin marking the occasion. The air raid sirens cut him off. He resumed. The sirens came again. Mosquitoes from the Pathfinder Force had found Berlin in daylight, on a day the Luftwaffe was supposed to have the capital of the Reich locked down tight. Göring had famously told the German people that if enemy aircraft ever reached Berlin, they could call him Meyer, a common surname. An insult in context. The Mosquito crews made him eat those words, and the German public understood exactly what it meant. The Pathfinder Force deserves its own mention here, because the Mosquito's role in guiding the heavy bomber offensive is often overlooked when people talk about the type. Number 8 Group, the Pathfinder Force, used Mosquitoes equipped with a precision navigation system called OBO. Two ground stations in England would track the aircraft's position and transmit tones to the navigator. When the tones aligned, you were on course. When a signal changed, you released your target markers. The Mosquito could carry those markers to within a few hundred yards of a target in the dark, from altitude, using nothing but radio signals and a trained navigator who knew how to listen. The heavy bombers, the Lancasters and Halifaxes behind them, bombed on the fires the Mosquitoes started. The accuracy of the entire Bomber Command night offensive improved measurably once the Pathfinder Force got the Mosquito. That is not a small thing when you consider the scale of that campaign. There is one mission I keep coming back to when I think about what this airplane and these crews were capable of. February 18, 1944, Amiens, France. Operation Jericho, the Gestapo had been systematically arresting members of the French resistance. The Amiens prison held dozens of them, French patriots who had been running networks, hiding downed Allied airmen, passing intelligence. The Gestapo was scheduled to execute many of them. The French resistance contacted the Royal Air Force and asked if anything could be done. 19 Mosquitoes from two group attacked the prison walls in three waves. The first wave blew the outer walls, creating gaps wide enough for people to run through. The second wave struck the German guard quarters. The third wave was held in reserve. The crews flew at low level in winter weather, under a low cloud ceiling that gave them no room for error. More than 200 prisoners escaped that day. The mission killed German guards and, in the chaos of the raid, some of the prisoners were also killed. War does not give you clean outcomes, but the men who would have faced the firing squad that week walked out through holes in the walls that Mosquito crews had put there at tremendous personal risk. And then there was Copenhagen, March 21, 1945. The Gestapo had established their headquarters in a building called the Shell House, six floors of a modern office building right in the middle of the Danish capital. In the attic of that building, the Gestapo was holding Danish resistance fighters, interrogating them, planning to execute them. 18 Mosquitoes attacked the Shell House at rooftop level. Rooftop level. Over a city, some aircraft clipped electricity wires on the approach run. The bombs went in through the lower floors, the fires burned upward, and the Gestapo personnel below never made it out. The prisoners in the attic got out in the smoke and the chaos, with guards abandoning their posts. Dozens of Danish resistance fighters walked out of that building and vanished into Copenhagen. Three mosquitoes were lost that day. A fourth aircraft crashed into a school, and children died in that accident. One of the most painful moments in the entire European air war. The mission was both an act of extraordinary precision and a tragedy. That is the truth of it, and the crews who survived knew both things at once. The Mosquito also served as a night fighter, one of the best of the war, fitted with airborne interception radar in a distinctive thimble nose and armed with four 20mm cannons and 4.303 machine guns. The night fighter Marx hunted German bombers over England and later escorted the heavy bomber streams deep into Germany, taking on the Luftwaffe night fighters that were stalking the Lancaster crews in the dark. The crews who flew the Mosquito loved it. There were waiting lists from Mosquito squadrons. Experienced aircrew volunteered to transfer for a chance at the type. And that tells you something. Combat pilots choosing an assignment is a vote of confidence that no performance specification can replicate. The airplane was demanding, particularly on one engine. Its asymmetric thrust on a single Merlin could bite hard if your technique was not precise. In tropical climates, the humidity worked on the wooden structure and the bonding compound in ways the designers had not fully anticipated, and mosquitoes in Southeast Asia had structural problems that required engineering attention. Nothing is perfect. But as a package, as an airplane that asked two men to do what took 10 on a Lancaster, and asked those two men to do it faster than most of what tried to kill them, it was extraordinary. 7,781 Mosquitoes were built across England, Canada, and Australia before production ended. That number stands as its own vindication of the idea that Geoffrey de Havilland fought for against institutional resistance, against the received wisdom of his industry, against the Air Ministry's certainty that wood had no future in modern war. A handful of Mosquitoes still fly today. Avstex Limited in Auckland, New Zealand has become the world leader in mosquito restoration, bringing multiple airframes back to airworthy condition. They understand the wooden structure, the redux bonding, the original construction methods at a level that requires craftsmen as much as mechanics. When you watch one of their restorations fly, and there's footage available if you look for it, what you see is the original idea made real again. Two Merlins in sync, that harmonic note that Merlin-powered airplanes make, the sound that defined the Battle of Britain. The Mosquito makes that sound and it looks nothing like the Spitfire. It looks like something from a different imagination entirely. Elegant, almost organic in its lines. Geoffrey de Havilland lost his own son in a Mosquito accident after the war, his son John, in 1946. The family paid a steep price for the aircraft that carries their name. That part of the story does not get told as often as the victory laps. I want to leave you with one number. During the entire Second World War, the Mosquito had the lowest loss rate of any aircraft in bomber command, lower than the heavies, lower than the mediums. An aircraft built of wood, flown by two, carrying no defensive guns, had the best survival rate of any type in the offensive against Germany. Geoffrey de Havilland was right. Speed is its own armor. It was true in 1940, and in one form or another, it is still true today. The best defense is sometimes just being somewhere else before the threat can close the range. Most of what I've drawn on today comes from Mosquito by Sharp and Bowyer, still the standard reference on the type, along with records from the de Havilland Aircraft Heritage Center and the Imperial War Museum at Duxford. You can find more aviation history at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, Blue Skies.